With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So we walk out, we walk down the steps, we get onto the pitch, and somebody shouted, "Foul!" So I turned around, and all of them were standing there with a beer in their hand going, "Cheers!" Rotten sods.
You're listening to the Lord's Cricket Podcast with me, Will Rowe. These are the stories from the home of cricket, with the people that made them.
Well, welcome to this episode of the Lord's Cricket Podcast, and it's my absolute pleasure to be joined by the legend that is Graham Foxy Fowler. We're actually recording this in Foxy's conservatory at his home in Durham. Foxy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
First question I'm going to ask actually is, where did the nickname come from?
My test debut was at Headingley in 1982 against Pakistan. And on Wednesday, we had nets, and started the game on Thursday. So I went in the dressing room to get changed after the gateman wouldn't let me in for 20 minutes because he didn't believe I was playing. So I eventually got in. I went into the dressing room and there was Ian Botham getting stuff out of his bag and getting ready. There was Bob Willis, who was the captain, in the far corner, and me. Yeah. So I just started getting ready and Bob Willis just said, "Foxy." So I looked up. I said, "Sorry?" He said, "Foxy." I said, why have you called me that?" He said, "That's your name now." Oh. So I went downstairs, out onto the ground, into the net. Vic Marks was making his debut as well. And he introduced me to all the lads as Foxy. So for the first few days, I'm running all over and people were shouting Foxy. I had no idea who they were talking to. And then I realised it was me. And that was it. That's how daft it was.
So it was Bob Willis that coined it.
Yeah.
Was it named after a some prison,
yeah, was,
escape
it,
prisoner from,
yeah,
like
was,
the 50s or something?
Yeah, he was in London and his nickname was Foxy Fowler, and he kept getting arrested. He was a petty thief, I think, and he kept escaping for wherever he put him. So that's, I don't know why he nicknamed me after that, but that's how the name came about, and it's stuck ever since. Unusually though, now when I meet Bob Willis, I get on with him really, really well. He calls me Graham, which is completely bizarre, because nobody else does.
Fair enough. When you made that test debut, you were playing for Lancashire. That's your county. That's where you grew up. The story has it that he rang you up and said, "I'd like you to come to Headingley," and you said, "Why?"
True. It's exactly true. See, what I thought, because we were off for rain, and I was, although I was a cap player, I was downstairs in the junior dressing room with a lot of my mates, and the dressing room attendant, Ron Spriggs, came in and said, "Fow," because I hadn't got the nickname Fox then,
yeah.
"Fow, Bob Willis is on the phone." Now, Ron Spriggs was an enormous practical joker. We also had phones downstairs around the back that were coin operated. So a lot of lads used to go around there, sit on those phones, ring upstairs,
right,
and play jokes. So I thought, here we go, it's just a joke. Bob Willis played for Warwickshire. And I had a run of 7 innings against Warwickshire where I didn't get less than 75, including 200s in a game at Southport with a runner. and he rang David Lloyd up. Apparently, I only found this way after. He said to Bumble, "He said, what's he like?" He said, "Well, he always gets runs against you, doesn't he?" And that must have been it, really. So I went upstairs and this voice said, "Hello, it's Bob Willis." He said, "Well, hello." He said, "I would like you to come to Headingley to next Wednesday to join the England squad." "Why?" well, he was taken aback. He said, "Well, because we want you to open the batting." "Oh, right. Okay. Thanks. Bye." That was it.
And then you turned up and they wouldn't let you in.
Yeah, they won't let me in. I had a 15-year-old Triumph 2000.
Right.
And this guy wouldn't let... He thought I was a netballer. And he said, "No, netballer's down the rugby." I said, no, I'm playing." He said, "You're not playing?" I said, "I am." He said, "Who are you?" I said, "I'm Graham Fowler." He said, "I've never heard of you." I said, "Well, you will do." And he said, "Well, I'll let you in today, but you're not coming in tomorrow." So I hadn't got any passes and stuff. So the following day, when I got passes, same gateman, he just completely just went, "Right, come on." Didn't apologise, nothing. I just drove straight past him.
And just over the ropes for the first four of the innings to Graham Fowler. So a very good and confident start by the young Lancastrian.
And it was quite a debut because you made 86, I believe, in the second innings. So you played well.
Second innings,
86.
Yeah. It ended up being the top scorer in the game because it was a bit of a seeming wicket.
Yeah.
And Etty Shamadin, a little fat chap, got me out in the first innings. It was a perfect ball to get a left-hander. It pitched off and hit off.
And he's bowled it. So Fowler goes, Edisham strikes, the ball knocking back the off stump, and England lose the first wicket with a total on 15. Fowler bowled, Edisham would in from 9.
And here we can see this, and I think we'll probably find it went through the gap. Yes, it just held up, it was a good delivery.
What was it like going into that England dressing room? Because you'd been sort of catapulted from...
You'd gone
quite quickly through the Lancashire, and then suddenly you were playing for England.
I'd gone from being a second 11 player at Lancashire to an international in 18 months. Just open the door and let the dog out. There's a...
There we go.
Just wedge it open with something, anything.
At this point, we pause to let one of Foxy's dogs into the back garden. We pick up the conversation around the 80s, a time when cricketers, the likes of Ian Botham, Mike Gatting and David Gower, might find themselves on the front pages of the tabloids as much as the back. The game was yet to become professional in the way we think about it today. So what was it like?
When I went on my first tour, which was an Ashes tour, we didn't have any nets or anything before we went. We had one meeting where we had a very flimsy physical examination. We got measured for clothes which never fit, and then we just all met at Lord's to get all this stuff and go to Australia. There was no practice whatsoever. And one of the things was, when we got to Brisbane, we had to run a 7-minute mile to prove we were fit. I could run a 7-minute mile backwards. You know, I used to do 5 miles in 27 minutes, not a 7-minute mile. And also, the thing that made me laugh was, well, it's a bit late, we're already in Brisbane. So what happens if somebody can't do it? What happens to them? And Eddie Emmons couldn't do it, but they didn't send him on.
Right.
So there was no professionalism at all. We didn't have a coach.
Yeah. But, I mean, that was also the tour where you fell backwards through a table, is that right? With Elton John's party? I had to get that story in somehow.
Yes. That was...
It was out in Australia, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, question...
No, it wasn't that tour.
Was it not?
It was the allegedly the sex, drugs and rock and roll tour at 83-84,
right,
which was Fiji, New Zealand, Pakistan, and I fell through the table in New Zealand, in Auckland.
Yeah, tell us that story, because that is bonkers. That is absolutely bonkers.
Well, the situation was that we had a few days off before we went to Pakistan. And during the afternoon, me and some people I'd met out there, we went to an outdoor concert, and you weren't allowed to take drinking, so we took Fanta in, which was half Fanta, half tequila, right? And we all had 2 litres each. So I drank that during the day, so I'm flying quite high. Get back to the hotel to find out that Elton's having a party, so I go up and I was thirsty, so I picked up what I thought was a tumbler of water, drank it, and it was just neat gin. So very shortly afterwards, I was completely drunk.
Yeah.
And slipped and fell backwards onto a glass top table, completely smashed it, drinks went everywhere. Incredibly, I didn't cut myself. And then I stood up and went out the way, and people were scurrying around trying to clean up. And I just stood next to Elton and Renata, and she was on my right. So I just turned my head sideways, and I could see her upper arm, so I just bit it. At which point she screamed and shouted, "Get him out of here."
And that Renata was his then wife?
His wife, yeah. 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 So they screamed, "Get him out of here." So Beefy took me out. But I didn't want to go, so I went back. Peter Reed, his manager, told me to get out, so, and I've never been in a fight in my life. I took a swing at it, missed and hit the wall. So Beefy got hold of me again in a headlock, took me out, took me to my room this time, and then I went back again. So this time Beefy just grabbed me around the neck, dragged me to my room, and I woke up next day. And he took me to hospital because I went to put my hand through a window outside. I don't know why I did that. The derelict building. And I was bleeding like mad all around there. You can still see the scars.
Yeah.
So he dragged me to hospital. He stitched me up. He took me back to the hotel. Put me in the room. And the following day I wake up. And my arm's bandaged from there to there. And I'm thinking, what have I done? Then it all came back. And I thought, oh my God. I'll have to go and apologise. I'll have to. And he was having a barbecue on his balcony, right? So it was later on in the day. It was about 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock or something. I can't remember the time. And I went up. I thought, I've got to go and apologise. So I knocked on the suite door. The door opened. I walked in, and everybody, I got standing ovation. Everybody stood up and applauded and cheered and... And I said, so I apologised. And they said, stay. I said, no, I'm too embarrassed to stay. So I didn't stay. And years later, I said to Elton, I said, why did I get a standing ovation? He said, you were the best entertainment we've ever had. He said, I thought cricketers were dull till I met you. So that's how we started a friendship.
It's a brilliant story. I mean, in terms of the professionalism, though...
There was none.
There clearly was none.
It was the end of the New Zealand leg.
Yeah, of course.
So we were just letting our hair down. I mean, yeah. Some of it's a bit too much. But then you go to Pakistan and start again.
Were there players in the side, though, which maybe would have frowned on that behaviour, who would have been, say, maybe more professional, so to speak?
Yeah, I would have frowned upon it.
Right.
I frowned upon it because I was more professional than that.
Yeah.
But yes, of course. Yeah, Beefy wasn't happy at all with how I behaved. And one of the reasons it was frustration is because I hadn't been in the team. Mm. I was the leading run scorer up to the first test match and I didn't get picked. And then when I did play, we played on the worst test wicket I've ever played on and then got a first bowler at Auckland. So I think I averaged 4. So I was, you know, that was the build-up of frustration, really.
Graham Fowler's born in 1957 in Accrington in Lancashire. It's the county where he spends most of his career, from humble beginnings to a university education, then onto opening the batting for England. We chat about Foxy's early life.
I was born 3 streets away. I was born in a terraced house. I was born 3 streets away from David Lloyd. He was in Water Street and I was in Bold Street, B-O-L-D, Bold Street. Although he was 10 years older than me. So our paths didn't cross then. But it was only when I went to university in Durham that I realised how good the sense of humour was in Accrington. It's just, everybody's like me and Bumble. It's a hilarious place to be. And then the other thing I realised was it doesn't rain as much in the rest of the world as it does in Accrington. But... I learned early on, when once I'd started mixing, like going for England under-17s camps or under-18s camps as they were then, and started mixing with people from other counties, the Chris Cowdrys, the David Gowers, that sort of Bill Athey, all those, I realised 2 things. One, their lives up to point had been completely different to mine. And two, because I had a very strong Lancashire accent, and it, believe it or not, this is, has been diluted through the years. But because I had a very strong accent, they thought my head buttoned up the back. They thought I was an idiot.
Right.
And once people think you are an idiot, it's amazing what you can find out. Because they'll, so you'll ask them a question, and they think, because you're such a clown, they tell you.
Yeah.
So I used to use that to my advantage.
Did you resent that at all, or were you sort of happy to play along with that?
I suppose I didn't like it initially, but then it didn't bother me. You know, it doesn't bother me. What's the point of that?
Yeah.
Well, why get bothered about where you've been brought up? That's, you know, it's just an act of geography, isn't it, really? So
and
could have been worse. Could have been a Brummy. From Bradford.
But, I mean, when you grew up, you weren't sort of naturally taken to cricket, as I understand it. You used to watch it on the TV because it was on the BBC. You'd watch, you know, the old guys playing. Yeah. But it wasn't... It was just something you sort of did. You know, you played it. You never, as I understand it, you never had aspirations to play for England because you didn't think that was a job. It was
I didn't. I didn't even realise. I was so naive.
Yeah.
I got picked to play for the Lancashire second team when I was 16. I didn't even know they had a second team. I didn't even know you could be a professional cricketer. I don't know what I thought. I just hadn't thought. It hadn't even crossed my mind. And once I started playing, I then, bit by bit, obviously realised that you could have a career out of it. And when, in 1974, John Savage, the England coach, said, the Lancashire coach at the end of the season, he was second 11 coach, he didn't do any coaching, he just carried the balls, but he was a lovely man. He just said, what are you doing next year? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we're going to offer you a contract. I said, oh, I'm going to university. All right. And not at any stage did I think, I'll not go to university. Because my father was born a fireman's son and he became a motor mechanic. My mum was a cotton mill weaver, and neither of them had an education past 11. And my dad, who I absolutely loved to bits, my mother's a different story, but my dad had always impressed on me two things. One, go as far as you can in your education. Go as far as you can, because it will always be useful no matter what level you get to. And also go as far as you can in your sport, because if you fulfil your potential, whatever level you get to, you can hold your hands up and be a proud man. So, and my dad was thrilled to bits that I got a place at university. So that was never in doubt. I was always going to go to university. And then I played, because university cricket back then wasn't like the centres of excellence I know.
No.
So I, Paul Allett and myself, we were at Bede at the same time. We used to nip home and play for Lancashire under-25s, club and ground, second 11. So through the 3 years at university, I actually played quite a bit for Lancashire 2s, and especially after... when Summeraldi started at university. And then I did my final exam on Friday in 1978. And on Monday morning, I started a professional career at Old Trafford.
Amazing.
Yeah, and funnily enough, I never even went back for my qualifications. It was a weird system. You cut 3-year B.Eds, didn't start at Durham until 1976, so I missed it by a year. But you could qualify for a fourth year if your results were good enough, and I qualified for the fourth year. So I rang up my personal tutor and I said, what do you think I should do, Pauline? She said, go and play cricket, you were never going to teach. Alright, okay. So that was it. I went.
And going into that Lancashire dressing room, it was quite stuffy. From
there was a lot of
it's quite traditional,
a lot of humour.
Yeah.
There's also a massive hierarchy.
Yeah.
And if you stepped out of line, you didn't know it. I mean, some of the old professionals were actually nasty.
Yeah.
You know, I was playing in the first team, and I was still a second 11 player. And I got out. So I'm changing downstairs. So I got out and I thought, well, I'd better go and sit with the lads who I'm playing with upstairs. Barry Wood, who wasn't playing at the time, was in the dressing room, and I walked in. He said, did you knock? I said, pardon? He said, did you knock on the dressing room to come in? I said, no, I'm playing in the game. He said, get out and knock. And he kicked me out, and I had to knock to come back in. So there was that sort of stuff going on.
Was that, is that the same at other counties, or was that particular to Lancashire?
Well, I mean, I wasn't in other dressing rooms.
Yeah.
But I'm fairly sure at that time it was, you know, there'd be quite a lot of that knocking about.
Yeah.
You know. So you had to be, I mean, I quite go up and whiten somebody's pads or the boots with sandpaper and linseed oil they're about. Yeah. I'm quite happy to do that. But one of the senior players actually said, after I'd done that, said, right, now go and wash my car. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. That's nothing to do with cricket. You wash your own bloody car.
In 1984, the West Indies are in England. Following a poor tour to New Zealand, where Foxy, amongst other things, such as falling through Elton John's coffee table, averages just four with the bat. He retains his place for the visit of the West Indies, but gets a duck and seven in the first test at Edgbaston, so arrives at Lord's for the second test with some serious self-doubt.
And it had been written in the press by a few journalists that Fowler is not good enough to play at this level. And I actually thought, well, if I have to play this lot every day, I'm not so sure whether I am. So I went to Lord's knowing that if I don't get runs here, I'm dropped. So that was at the back of my mind. But and I suppose for the first time in my life, I couldn't sleep before the first day. But I always did what I always did, went and had a few pints first and had a meal and went to bed. And I was just pacing the floor. And it got to about 3 o'clock and I still hadn't been to sleep. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. So I rang down to room service and got 3 pints of Guinness sent up. Because I thought, I'm better off getting some sleep and may have a little bit of a thick head rather than be awake all night. So I had 3 pints of Guinness sent up and necked them as quickly as possible. Went to bed and slept. and then we opened... We batted first, didn't we?
Yeah, you batted first. So you went out, you opened the batting with Chris Broad.
That was his debut.
Yeah. David Gower was captaining. So out you go.
Was Gower captain? Are you sure?
100%. I hope so, yeah. He definitely was. Gower was captain for that match.
Okay. Right,
so David Gower was captaining. So you bat first, you're a little bit hungover.
No, I wasn't actually. I felt
all right.
Yeah, I think the adrenaline must have kicked in. I was fine. I was right as rain.
And it was a bit of one of those miserly type days, you know, it was a bit of grey, a bit of rain here and there. And obviously you make your way through the long room and then out to face, barring maybe the Aussies, the greatest fast bowling attack ever.
Yeah, it was, Garner and Marshall opened up together. And they were really freaky to play against because... If Malcolm Marshall bowled a particular length, you had to go forward. But if Joel Garner bowled that length, you had to go back because of the steepness of the bounce. So it really messed around with your head a little bit. But the good thing for me, well, it was good and bad. The good thing for me was we kept going off for a bit of drizzle and a bit of rain. I don't know how many times I went off, but that gave me a mental rest. Unfortunately, it gave them a physical rest. So they just came out refreshed again. But... I think it must have worked better for me than it did for them because I think I was 70 not out that night.
Yeah, overnight you were 70 not out.
And guess what? I couldn't sleep again.
So what did you do?
Order another 3 pints of Guinness. Well, I thought this worked. It worked yesterday. I'll give it another go.
So you go out the next day and then, you know, you're on 70 not out. I think you hooked Malcolm Marshall?
Yeah, twice. Two best hook shots I ever played in my life.
What were you thinking?
I have no idea. It was two consecutive balls as well.
Because it wasn't in your repertoire to hook.
No, I didn't usually hook. No, yeah. I usually got out of the way. But I think the two shots took me into the 90s.
Yeah.
I have no idea why I played them. I don't know. I just did. But they were the two best ones I ever played.
And then they brought on Roger Harper.
Yippee!
So they bring on the spinner. And then that was your moment.
Yeah, I slug swept him over long gone.
Yeah.
And that was against the spin, but that was something I could play. I did.
Well, he went for the big one and well-executed shot. Fetched it in the right area. He just had to clear Garner at mid-on. It takes him now on to 99.
And then the next ball, he bowled it short and I rocked back and cut it behind square to get me 100.
And that's it.
Beautiful square cut this time for four runs, consecutive fours, taking Graham Fowler on to a really magnificent 100. How well he's battled. Great test of temperament, of courage, and particularly today of skill. He's improved as the game has gone on, and he reaches 103 out of 238 for four. 13 boundaries in his 100. This is his second Test match 100, and Clive Lloyd very nicely walks over to shake hands with him.
And then Eldon Baptiste coming out.
He's gone this time, very safely caught at second slip. So it flashed out there once or twice off Eldon Baptiste later. But just a little bit of lack of concentration after he'd gone to three figures. Sees the end of a really excellent performance from Graham Fowler. 106, and it's 243 for five, and the first wicket for Eldon Baptiste. Looks a bit tired, a little bit weary, but he's done a magnificent job here for England today.
To me, Lord's is like whatever, and a lot of people will say this, it's the finest ground in the world. Although it was incredibly hard work, I found it a privilege to be playing against the best bowling attack in the world, playing against the best team in the world. I mean, they didn't lose a series for 15 years. That's an enormous stretch of time. So I found it a privilege. I found it hard work, obviously. But so I loved getting that 100. It meant a lot to me. One, because it was at Lord's. Two, because it was against the West Indies. And also the captain of the West Indies was my county captain, Clive Lloyd. So he waited. I was batting with Beefy at the time, so Beefy shook me on, and I've got a photo of that somewhere. And then when everything had died down, Clive walked up from the first to second slip all the way up, and that was about 30 yards to shake my hand, and that meant a lot because he'd been a big influence on me.
That
he did something wonderful in my second test match. I got out cheaply in the first innings, and I was not out overnight in the second innings. No mobile phones, no Skype, and he rang my room in Brisbane. So he worked out where I was, what the number was, what the time difference was, and he rang me up when he knew I'd be getting up, and he said to me, "You can do this. You've done it before. You did it, Headingley. You can do this again. Don't worry about how you've been playing. Just you." And I thought, wow, from the captain of the world, really. That was an incredibly inspiring thing. You know, that was a privilege for somebody like Clive to ring me up and say, "You can do it."
A real shows the class of the man.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Back to Lord's, and after Graham scores his 106, England establish a first innings lead of 41 runs. They then rack up 300 for 9, declaring on the final morning, setting the West Indies 342 to win. But England forgets about one thing: Gordon Greenidge.
It's a great shot. Had some really good shots this morning, Gordon Greenidge.
I was fielding at cover. Lammy was at point, and Gordon Greenidge was famous for his square cuts. It didn't matter where we were, he hit it in between us.
Four, square drive. Just whizzing past Graham Fowler at point.
We ended up at 1.5 yards apart, and he still hit it in between us. We just couldn't stop him.
Yeah.
And in those days, you didn't put a fielder on the boundary to save the four. That was just where Test cricket was played.
Just had an infield.
Yeah, just had the infield.
Yeah.
You know, apart from a deep square leg, I think that was about it.
Yeah.
And he just kept smashing it between us. And they walked it. Absolutely walked it.
Beautiful shot. Put through mid-wicket for yet another boundary.
So strong here around his leg stump, and that was the area that Foster fed him. The full swing of the bat there. There it is. The players are off. Four to Gomes. A win for the West Indies by 9 wickets. 214 not out to Gordon Greenidge. Magnificent innings from him, and a very, very good knock from Larry Gomes. 92 he made in the total of 344 for one. And what seemed to be an almost impossible assignment at the start of this innings has turned out to be an absolute dollar.
Coming off after that match as a side, you must have thought, these guys are unbeatable.
That was a massive, massive blow, because we, as you said, we had a first innings lead. We chose to declare, if we bowl them out, we're 1-1 in the series. But that was an absolutely hammer blow to get beaten after we'd declared. And it knocked everybody back. Because they had such confidence and ability that they could turn a match from any situation. I used to go out for supper with Michael during the test match when I got chance.
Michael Holding.
Yeah, yeah. And he was talking to me and saying that, you know, well, if four fast bowlers, he said, if one of us is having an off day, he said, the other three automatically take on these overs. We'll do it. So he said, so if you have a slight off day, I don't know what an off day was for Michael Holden, then we'll take over. So they had that unique ability to go, it's all right, I'll do it. And then the batting was exactly the same. But they all went in saying, I can do this. But if they got out, the next one went in, well, don't worry, I'll get your runs as well. So that was just incredible. And it was Clive who built that up in them. He turned them from being a group of islanders into the West Indies.
Yeah.
You know, and that was because when he first took over, you know, there was rivalry between the rivals, between the islands. And he got rid of all that. And he just made them into a force, you know, and they just believed they could do it. Absolutely believed.
I interviewed him the other year, and he actually said that when he got the call, he'd only ever captained his school team. So he was a bit shocked by that one. He said, oh, what, you want me to do this? And they said, yeah, please. And yeah, he obviously had that ability to just bring people together.
Beautiful diplomat. I played for a World 11 in the West Indies at Jamaica Festival. And it was Andy Roberts and Michael Holding, Malcolm Marshall and Sylvester Clark. It's supposed to be a festival game. Mendo got knocked over, hit him on the head and got knocked over off Mako. Because he used to have this thing, often either the first or the second ball of a spell was a bouncer. And he hit Mendo straight on the visor and knocked him over. And all he could say, after I stopped laughing, I said, are you all right? He said, all this way to get pinned. And that's all he could say, I've just come all this way to get pinned. But they were, and at one point, I smashed Michael Holding through extra cover because there were no fielders in front. There's only Desmond Danes at bat pad. And I smashed it, Mikey, at head height through extra cover. And I did it two balls running. And he just walked down the wicket and said, foul, are these not coming down fast enough? You take it easy, I take it easy. So the next ball was the same ball, and I blocked it. He went, that was that.
Between 1982 and 1985, Foxy plays 21 tests for England, scoring 3 centuries, averaging 35.32, opening the batting. 34 years on from that test against the West Indies, we chat about life in the dressing room.
Well, there was a lot of humour in the dressing room, a lot of humour. There was also a lot of frustration, especially against the West Indies. Yeah, it's just ridiculous.
How did you pass the time in those rain breaks? I mean, you and the team in general. Did guys read the paper?
Yeah.
Chat?
Crosswords, chat. If it's raining for a long time, a lot of them would play bridge.
Right.
Beefy liked to play cribbage with Jeff Miller if he was there. He played one continuous game of cribbage through the entire New Zealand tour. And they worked out at the end that Beefield, Jeff Miller, something like 1,700 quid. So Beefy gave him the cheque and he tore it up. And he said, it was never about the money. But they played all tour. One continuous, one kept adding up all the points and stuff.
That was life in an England dressing room in the 1980s.
Yeah,
it must have been an amazing place, though. Do you sit here now and sort of... Are those your fondest memories?
I don't know, really. I've got many of them.
Yeah.
Many of them. One of my fondest memories of Lloyd's was... Because when Nancy was... I mean, the food's still beautiful now. Mm. But when Nancy was in charge...
Nancy was the dinner lady or the...
She looked after
the players' dining room. Yeah, quite legendary, I believe.
Yeah, she is. And her food was the best anywhere in England. It was magnificent. And we had a rather large off spinner called Jack Simmons. He must have been 16 stone, right? Food was his passion. And we went off, we were fielding, and we went off for lunch. It was a nice warm day, and Jack's had a feast. And near the window, where the doors that open onto the little balcony, there was some armchairs, and he always got changed in one of them. So while I'd lunch, and it's about 5 minutes ago, and we turn around and we look, and Jack Simmons is fast asleep. So rather than wake him up, we all went, shh. And we all tiptoed out and went onto the pitch. And one of the umpires said, "You've only got 10. He said, "I know, Simmons asleep, we've left him." So we played for about 4 or 5 overs with just 10 men. Then all of a sudden we see Simo standing on the balcony with his arms outstretched going, "What's happening?" And he came on, he was furious. Absolutely. He was calling everybody up, every name under the sun, because we hadn't woke him up. And he blamed all of us. It wasn't his fault for falling asleep.
Why did he doze off?
Well, he'd had so much to eat. He'd had so much to eat.
Did you still play in the days when you could drink at lunchtime? I mean, I'd have a pint of ale. I think Mike Gatting said that was still happening to the late 70s.
They were always on the table at Headingley, always pale ale and bitter. And when I was in the Lancashire dressing room, the 12th man's duty was to take a drinks list for the end of the day. And I reckon now to 12 drinks plus the scorer, there would plus the manager, there may be one non-alcoholic drink. So you'd often, in the 3-day game, you'd often have to go in at bat at 10 to 6 for a horrible 40 minutes. Mm. You knew you were going to get peppered. So me and Mendo used to get ready and be something, "Well, will you pass me that pint of lager?" And so we just said, "Look, lads, we know you're going to drink when we go out, but do you not have to do it whilst we're padding up before we go out?" Right? Just please. So they did. They kept quiet. Nobody said anything. And then so we walk out, we walk down the steps, we get onto the pitch, and somebody shouted, "Foul!" So I turned round, and all of them were standing there with a beer in their hand going, "Cheers!" Rotten sods.
Those are the days at Lancashire. Talking about Lancashire, it was your county, but it didn't end particularly well. I think you
No, I got sacked.
Well, yeah, it did, yeah.
That was what happened.
Yeah, I mean, you stood up for Wasim Akram. There was an incident, and then that was sort of, that was the beginning of the end in the late 80s.
Yeah, so. And also, the other factor was that in 1990, we won the Benton Edges and the NatWest combined, and we had Davies Hughes as captain, who batted number 9 and didn't bowl. So 10 of us played out of skins. Mm. Anyway, in 91, we had some good lads in the second 11. You know, people like Graham Lloyd, who ended up playing Wand Internationals. And we were a batsman light. And we actually, I think it was 89, we won the Sunday League. And the plan was to chase. And we had three batsmen, which was Guy Mendes, me and Neil Fairbrother. Coming in four was Mike Watkinson, who's not a bad player, but he's not a number four. Mm. And we actually won that by us playing really well. But in 91, we weren't playing as well. So that we needed the 11th player. And David Hughes didn't like that. He took it the wrong way. And he basically told the club that Paul Allett and me had organised a mutiny, and Bob Bennett added on to the thing where I tried to support Wasim, and I just got called in and got sacked. So, I mean, if I saw Bob Bennett, I'd have a drink with him. If I saw David Hughes, I'd have a drink with him.
Yeah.
You know, but that's what happened then. Move on, you know. And nobody had ever left Lancashire nicely. Nobody.
Right.
Nobody ever did. David Lloyd, Clive Lloyd, nobody.
It's just sort of part of the fabric of the county,
It was all part of the fabric of the committee, yeah.
Yeah.
The way it was. You'd walk, at the end of the season, you'd walk in to the committee room and you would either get a 1-year, a 2-year, a 3-year contract, or they'd just tell you you're sacked, empty your locker and go home. And it was that. That was it. There's no warning, no nothing.
So, after 17 years at Lancashire, Foxy moves on to the next chapter. He joins Durham in 1992, but it's short-lived as he struggles with a shoulder injury and is also seen to run off with the then marketing manager, Sarah, his wife now of 24 years, as his marriage is breaking down. Many at the county are unhappy with the scandal as it becomes tabloid news. Foxy Fowler faxes for divorce is one of the more catchy headlines, despite not being true, he assures me. So after 2 years, he moves on. In 1996, Foxy sets up the Centre of Excellence at Durham University and begins life as a coach.
Well, I used to coach the kids in Scarborough in Western Australia, in Perth, when I went out there, and I enjoyed it, and I became an advanced coach, which is now the equivalent to level 3, and there only was 3 levels back then in 1979. So I was a qualified teacher, qualified coach, and I like coaching and teaching. I like both of those. I think I really enjoy them, and there's nothing better than helping somebody become a better player, you know, and that I got great satisfaction out of.
Were you more interested in the individual or sort of the team progress?
Nothing but the individual.
I
set up the Centre of Excellence to help young cricketers finish their education, so their degree came first, finish their education and progress their cricket at the same time. Because when I went to university, my cricket more or less stayed still for 3 years. So, and it was 20 years later, it's the same situation, more or less. So I wanted to set this up to help them progress. And the big difference was, as well, was when I went to university, only something like 8% of the population went.
Mm.
Well, now it's 49. So 49%, simple maths, 49% of your 18-year-old cricketers is going to be in university. So, and there are a lot of jobs you can't apply for now, minimum qualification degree.
Mm. Yeah.
So that all made sense, and that's what I did. And we've sent... Well, from Durham, we sent over 60 lads into first-class cricket. I had four play for England, five county captains, Andy Strauss, the assistant coach of the England women's team, Alistair Maiden. You know, we had the university this year had a pre-season game against Durham County, and the two opening batsmen from Durham County had been to Durham University. So it was just a very simple system. And so it was all about the individual. If we had a good team, that was a byproduct.
Yeah.
Because my main emphasis, I mean, was on helping players. Now, that didn't always go down well with the university because they like to win trophies and get bucks points and stuff like that. And I would say, well, look, what would you rather have? Somebody who goes on to be captain of England or win a little tin pot trophy at university level? So I met with opposition, because that's how I put it as well.
Yeah.
So I met with opposition about that. But I was determined. This system, this scheme is to help cricketers to finish their education and develop into first-class cricket and hopefully beyond. So I never budged.
As a person, I'm sitting here with you now and having read your book, you're very good at sort of saying that's done and move on. You don't sort of dwell on things. I mean,
no, because I don't. Obviously, something ends, but I prefer to think that something else is starting.
Yeah.
A lot of things, like people say, do you miss playing? And I'll say no, and they don't believe me. They just don't believe that I mean it. And I said no, because I enjoyed that when I was doing it. It's done. Why would I miss it? I had a life of it. So now I'm doing something else. So something else is starting. And I said to him, talking to one bloke one day, and I said, well, you know, what do you do for a living? He said, oh, I'm retired now. I said, all right, okay. I said, what did you used to do? He said, no, I was an accountant. I said, oh, at weekends, do you do some accountancy? He said, no. I said, well, why would I play cricket then?
Well, I think cricket is probably more enjoyable than being an accountant.
Yeah, but my point was, that's what he used to do.
Yeah.
And for me, I could never turn a profession into a hobby. I mean, what for? You know, I'll be playing on soft wickets against rubbish bowlers, compared to the West Indies rubbish bowlers.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't be like... How much fun would that be? I'd hate it. Also, if I get 100, I'm supposed to. If I don't get 100, I'm a donkey. Mm. And the other thing that really matters to me is I'm keeping somebody else out of the team.
Yeah.
No matter which team I'm playing for, I'm keeping somebody else out. Now, I've had enough cricket and enough fun in cricket to last a lifetime. So why would I stop somebody else having fun? You know, so I was never ever... I played two charity matches in 95... And that was it.
And not to drop this in like that, one of those kind of clangers in a TV series, but we've been talking about your whole cricket career here, and you mentioned that injury, fielding injury you sustained. But in 1978, you'd suffered a car crash, which basically meant through most of your career, in layman's terms, you were playing with a broken neck.
Yeah. C4, C5 and a bit of C6 were crushed.
Yeah.
It was a head-on crash. It wasn't my fault. Bloke was on the wrong side of the road as I went round a bend. And as I went forward, I had a seatbelt on, and they weren't compulsory, but I had one on. As I went forward, I remember going down. I bent the steering wheel with my arms, and my head hit the gear lever. And I never bounced back. And it was the actual going forward that the crushing absorbed all the shock.
Yeah.
If it hadn't crushed, I'd then bounced back and got whiplash. So I broke my leg in it as well, so they found that. But nobody ever x-rayed my neck or anything. And what happened, over time, I'd get a pain under the shoulder blade. And it would, I'd have it for a couple of days and then it'd go away. But over time, it became more consistent, stronger, it hurt more, until eventually, I still can't. I can only turn to there. That way I can do that. So it was all right batting.
Yeah. For the sake of the podcast, you're turning to your right-hand side here. Yeah,
exactly. but the problem was that once I played the shot and followed through, that's almost basically like turning your head to the left.
Yeah.
It's just that your body does it, and that used to kill. So I went back to the consultant, and he re-x-rayed my neck, and he said, yep, that's what you've done. So
it's amazing that you managed to play your career with that injury.
There were
I mean, you didn't know it at the time. No. Which maybe psychologically changes it. I'm sure it does.
Well, I knew afterwards.
Yeah,
because you can't uncrush them.
Yeah.
But what happened, the reason I got the pains was because the bones were recalcifying, so they were trapping nerves.
Right.
So I think in total I had 4 manipulative operations where they give you a general anaesthetic and you just screw your head round and break all the bits off. And David Markham was an incredible surgeon who looked after me. He said, "You are lucky." He said, "Because you could have just landed the wrong way and it would have been curtains." But even after knowing I had these crushed bones, I mean, I still dived about. I wasn't going to stop.
Mm.
Because, I don't know, you just can't, can you? You know, this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
This is me living. This is what I love doing. So I'm just going to carry on.
When Graham was 47, 10 years after his playing career finishes, he's diagnosed with depression. He goes on to speak very publicly about his battles with mental illness. I asked Foxy if he feels his time in the game as a cricketer in any way caused his depression, or if it was a pre-existing condition within him.
That's one of the hardest questions to answer. Only thing that used to happen to me was every September I'd lock myself in my house. After the season had finished, I'd have a week to myself. I'd unplug the phone, lock the front door, draw the curtains, and I'd just go and get a big pile of videos.
Yeah.
Because that was modern technology back then.
VHS?
I got past the Betamax. And I'd go down to the video store and get a load of videos. And I'd eat when I was hungry, I'd have a drink when I wanted to, and I'd go to bed when I wanted to, and I'd just watch videos for a week. And I interpreted that as recharging my batteries.
Mm.
And I was always sad in September, because I always knew you've only got so many seasons in you. So every September, that's one less. Now, whether they were tiny episodes of mild depression, I don't know.
Yeah.
I didn't think they were at the time. I just thought I'm just recharging my batteries, because if you're playing from April till September, there are some days when you don't feel as well as you should do because you've eaten something dodgy the night before, or you got lost on the way to traveling down to the hotel, so you've not got as much sleep. So I always thought, right, I've used energy I don't have, physical energy. I've used mental energy that I don't have, and I've used emotional energy, and so I've depleted all those. So I just want to wait to myself just to get them back up again. Cricket's there's a lot of stress in cricket.
Mm.
Some of it's good stress, and we like that. You know, you get to that exciting point of a match where if you can get through these next 4 overs, you know, you're well on your way to winning, or we've lost 3 quick wickets, I've got to dig in, or there's a catch gone up, if catch this we win, you know. So, but that's great stress because we love it. There's also bad stress when if you're having a bad run and you can't get a run anywhere. Now, that was never too bad for me, because by the time I had a really bad run, this was 85.
Mm.
So I'd had my test career. So I had that back knowledge that, and it was my neck as well. Once I get my neck sorted out, I'll be okay. But for a lot of young lads who were sort of in and out of the first team, they're always wondering, oh, well, I need to get in the first team to get some runs or get some wickets, because if I don't, they're not going to give me a contract. So there's a lot of that type of stress for a lot of players, but I was lucky enough not to have that. So I don't think cricket caused anything. I don't think there was a cause. It was just my head went on holiday.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you've been an idiot for 40-odd years. My brain's just said, I'm going on holiday. Get lost. And it went.
On that, when you're talking about cricket as a game, compared to something like football, it does lend itself to a certain type of loneliness. Now, I'm not talking about you personally. I'm just saying, if you know, it's a team game, but it's also an individual game.
Yeah, of course.
If you're a footballer, and say you're a right back, and you make a mistake, you stay on the pitch. You know, you have to get back and defend for the next corner, and your team can go on to win the game. In cricket, if you're a batsman, you get a duck, the team can win. But you can then be sat in the dressing room, sort of alone with your own thoughts, having let people down, or in your mind you've let people down.
Yeah, oh God, yeah. You have to learn to deal with that.
And you spend a lot of time on the road. You know, you've got a week in Derby, say, and you're staying in like a travel lodge. Whereas, in football, it's 90 minutes.
Yeah.
You can arrive on the morning, play at 3 o'clock, and you can be home by 7 or 8, depending on where you are. Does that in the work you've done with some of the younger cricketers now, do you find that there's a it lends itself to kind of a loneliness more than maybe other sports.
I think it certainly does, yeah. I mean, the when my first England tour was 22 and a half weeks.
Yeah.
You know, 22 and a half weeks, and I wasn't playing very well at the beginning. And if you're in a single room, which all the players are these days, we weren't, it was just the captain and vice, we were sharing. If I hadn't have been sharing, I'd have gone round the bend, because I needed somebody to talk to anywhere. Never mind when I was not playing very well. I liked company. So to sit in a room all evening on my own, I'd have hated it. So I was lucky that I shared rooms with people and had some great roommates. But 22 and a half weeks is a ridiculous amount of time to go on tour.
Mm.
You know, at the time I didn't have children until the finished playing. But I can't imagine being away for that long if you've got two kids at home. That's terrible. And when I played, if you wanted your wife to come out, whichever wife it was at the time, you had to pay for them. So you paid for them to fly, you paid for the hotels, you paid for them to fly back. So, you know, not like today where they all fly a club class and get put up in the hotel. No, we had to pay for ours. I got back into England after my first test series away. I had 850 quid left. All my mates thought I was a millionaire because I'd been playing for England. Well, that was it. That's what I had left.
Yeah.
For 6 months' work. But I wouldn't swap it, mind you. I wouldn't change it. I'm not complaining. Yeah. I'm just saying this is what it was like.
Yeah. It's not all sort of roses from the outside, and I guess the public and cricket fans looking and say, well, you've got the best job in the world. You go to the West Indies, the Caribbean, Australia, you know, South Africa. What are you complaining about? But actually, it's not quite like that.
It's not. But so if I was getting sort of fed up, if you like, emotionally down, and there's a difference between an emotional down and a mental health down.
Yeah.
If I was getting emotionally down, I'd kick myself up the arse and say, look, you're playing for England, you're travelling the world, stop whinging. And I'd basically have that conversation to myself and think, this is the time of your life, because if you don't enjoy that, how dreadful is it going to be when I get to age 40 and I look back and think I didn't make the most of this? So wherever we were, I always used to take a camera bag with me. Wherever we were, I wouldn't sit in my hotel in the afternoon if we were doing nothing. I'd go out with my camera and go for a walk and explore, because I thought, right, I might never be back here, which is proved quite true. In a lot of places, I haven't been back.
Yeah.
But so I always kick myself up the arse about that. No, this is what you're doing. Yeah.
And these days, now you're a grandfather.
Yep.
New lease of life.
I don't think I lost the old one. Yeah, little Zara. Yeah,
new challenges, though.
Well, it's funny, really, because she's almost identical to how her mother was when she was little. So it's like reliving things. I mean, she's such a cute little thing. Well, she's two at the moment, so she's either laughing her head off or she's screaming. You know, terrible twos is definitely correct. But yeah, I love it. Yeah, it's great. Well, family's everything to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, my family. Not everybody else's. Mine. Yeah. You know, my own family. No, I mean, I don't mean cousins and aunts and uncles. I don't mean that lot. I mean, just who grew up in this house.
Yeah. So your wife, Sarah, your three daughters,
and Sarah.
The ones that, and maybe more little ones to come. It's been great recording with you today. There's so many stories that we could go over, but we've had to kind of stick to that 106 against the West Indies. We've also had the company of your two dogs, which has been lovely. just to finish on talking about your family and Sarah and the kids, you give yourself a scale of sort of 0 to 20 on how you're feeling.
Yeah, 10's neutral.
How is Foxy Fowler at the moment?
I'm a 15, 16 is the highest it ever gets. So I'm in a great place at the moment.
In a great place. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time today, and really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Foxy.
Cheers.
That was fantastic, mate.
And we'd have another cup of tea.
You've been listening to the Lord's Cricket Podcast, the stories from the home of cricket with the people that made them. That was Graham Foxy Fowler with his memories from his 1984 Test century against the West Indies here at Lord's. It was great fun to sit down with Foxy, a real character of the game. He just has so many great stories and anecdotes to tell from his playing career and beyond, really. It was really good fun. I certainly hope that came across. I first met Foxy about 3 or 4 years ago when I went up to Durham to do some filming around the Centres of Excellence, and myself and a couple of colleagues went for a pint with him in the evening, and he just kind of held court, really. He's the kind of guy that if you get him, you know, with a pint of ale in a pub, just that lovely Lancashire accent that he has, just can just sit there and tell yarn after yarn after yarn and not be boring, you know, be great fun. I would heavily recommend his book, Absolutely Foxed. It's an autobiography, it's about his career, but it's also about much, much more than cricket. I'll put a link to it in the liner notes of this podcast. I also believe he's got a new book coming out, Mind Over Batter, which should be available in May 2019. So keep an eye out for that. That's his second book, Mind Over Batter, or his second part of his kind of autobiography series. As ever, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Please do subscribe and give the show a rating. It helps get it up the charts, and hopefully more people will discover it and then listen to it and enjoy the stories. You can follow us on Twitter at Home of Cricket, or me personally at Will Rowe 2. You can also contact the show via email on podcast@mcc.org.uk. Also, a big thanks as ever to the BBC and ECB for the commentary clips. Always great to have those in, and listening back to Gordon Greenwich taking England to the cleaners here at Lord's in 1984. A little bit before my time, but the dulcet tones of Richie Beno there. That was fantastic listening back to that. Right, next Monday's guest is Nasser Hussain. After prizing him out of the Sky commentary box, well, that's not true, really. He popped up to the Lord's Media Centre ahead of a T20 match earlier this summer, and we chatted about his fairy tale ending, which came here at Lord's. It was in 2004. Hussain bowed out with an unbeaten century at the home of cricket. It was against New Zealand. He'd run Andrew Strauss out famously in that innings, but he managed to stick in there batting with his pal Graham Thorpe at the other end. And on one of those dappled late evening afternoons, Nasser got down on one knee and drove the ball through the covers for four to hit an unbeaten century and win that test match against New Zealand. A few hours later, he was done, retired from international cricket. We chat about that century. That's the main part of the podcast. Also about his famous three-finger gesture to the Lord's Media Centre, which I'm sat in right now, and plenty, plenty more. It was a great privilege to sit down with Nasser. He's quite an intense bloke. He captained England through a genuine transition period in the late 90s and early noughties. So that's next week's Lord's Cricket Podcast with Nasser Hussain.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.